Today, provide you with in-depth news and expert analysis, tell you the whole story and the bigger picture. Bring you the news you want to know only on Today.
Chinese Premier Li Keqiang calls on China, Japan and South Korea to safeguard free trade and expand cooperation. Malaysia's Mahathir Mohamad on course to be the world's oldest elected leader. Argentina seeking credit line from IMF. You're listening to Today, a news program with a different perspective. I'm Zhao Ying. Coming up, we'll have an hour of world news and analysis. If you have any questions or want to leave a comment, simply follow us on Weibo. We are 今日, Today on CRI. To hear this episode again or catch up on previous episodes, you can download our podcast by searching World News Analysis. China, Japan, and South Korea have agreed to a new way to cooperate. The agreement has come as part of a trilateral meeting in Tokyo among the leaders of the countries for the first time in more than 2 years. Xie Cheng has more.
Chinese Premier Li Keqiang has called for sticking to the direction of dialogue and consultation so as to peacefully settle the Korean Peninsula issue. He has made the remark while attending the 7th China-Japan-South Korea Leaders Meeting in Tokyo.
希望各方都能够抓住当前的时机。
We hope that all parties concerned will seize the current opportunity to promote the resumption of a dialogue and create conditions for the peaceful settlement of the nuclear issue and for peace and stability of the region. China will continue to play its constructive role in this respect.
The Premier has congratulated the DPRK and South Korea on their historic summit last month. He also hopes that the planned meeting between Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump will be smoothly carried out. During the summit, Li Keqiang has also called for a new cooperation mode of China, Japan, South Korea plus X. In explaining the concept, the Premier suggested the three sides, with leading economies in Asia, should open up the fourth party or even multi-party market to promote the rapid, sound development of the entire continent.
By opening our markets to one another at a wider level, our three sides can present tremendous opportunities to other parties and also develop together with other parties.
He also used the meeting to call for joint efforts to promote the trilateral relations to a new level.
所以我们愿意本着三方已经
We're looking to the future and making active efforts to promote the relations of our three countries to a new level. We are willing to properly control and tackle our differences so as to make sure the relations of our three countries move on the right track of sustainability, health and stability. China has come with sincerity and goodwill.
The Chinese Premier is also urging accelerated negotiations for a trilateral free trade agreement and the achievement of the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership at an early date, in a bid to promote the building of an East Asian economic community.
That is Xie Cheng reporting. For more on this, we're now joined on the line by Yang Xiyu, research fellow with the China Institute of International Studies. So, Dr. Yang, thank you for joining us. What do you make of this? What do you make of the significance of this trilateral talks?
I think the trilateral talks, firstly, is very timing. Not only on the peninsula, but also on the East Asia, Northeast Asia as a whole. Previously, all of the three countries, Japan, China, and South Korea, suffered a lot from the bad shape of the relationship. And now, the individual bilateral and the general trilateral has been on the improvement track. So the summit among the three will input a great momentum for the further improvement of the trilateral relation as well as the trilateral cooperation for the reason, both politically and economically. And secondly, the timing reflects that the three countries determined to cooperate further to handle not only economic challenges, but also the regional security challenges. That means the cooperation between the three going in depth and going wider range. So through this summit, I think that will be a new starting point for the China-Japan, China-South Korea, South Korea-Japan, and the trilo as a whole development. That will input more and more momentum for the sustainable prosperity for this region.
Well, we know that the trilateral summit has been long postponed due to history and territorial disputes and political issues. Then what brings them together at this very moment? I mean, do you feel that this is based on some real shared strategic interest or rather some shared worries like the protectionist policies from the Trump administration?
Well, the pictures now is very complicated and mixed. On one hand, you're right. Both China, Japan, and South Korea are facing the similar or same challenges, ranging from the security arena and the economic arena. Primarily, the challenges from Trump administration by enhancing the protectionism. That really make a serious stress for the three countries' sustainable, stable economic growth. And furthermore, the protectionism enhanced by U.S. is actually a challenge to the existing global free trade and investment system. That is the base for every country's sustainable development. China, Japan, South Korea has have shared a responsibility to guarantee, to save the global system in stable and a sustainable manner to protect, to oppose Americans' protectionism. So that is the reason, one of the reasons for the three countries to get closer. But also, in the individual bilateral, through the related parties' efforts, the individual bilateral relations has been improved. That's a better base for the broader range of the cooperations among the three.
Well, Li Keqiang has called for a new cooperation mode of China, Japan, South Korea plus X. How would you understand this new cooperation mode?
Has got a relevant response from Japan and South Korea.
Well, it seems that there are some technical problems. We'll try to get Mr. Yang back. But now let's take a look at some breaking news. Chinese authorities have received a letter from U.S. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin officially visiting Chinese Vice Premier Liu He to visit the United States for further economic and trade consultations. The Ministry of Commerce says the Chinese side has accepted the invitation and agreed to visit the United States at a proper time. It says teams for both sides are maintaining close communications. It is expected Liu He will be traveling to the U.S. sometime next week to continue with their trade talks. And Liu He led the Chinese delegation during the previous round of talks with the U.S. in Beijing last week. And now we're getting Mr. Yang back on the line. So, Dr. Yang, could you explain more on this China, Japan, South Korea plus X mode?
The picture of the trilateral relation among the three are quite mixed. On one hand, there have been greater improvement of the individual bilaterals and the trilateral in general. But on the other hand, some sharp differences between countries like Japan, China, Japan, South Korea remain there. But fortunately, all the three leaderships from the three capitals have got the same determination to strengthen the cooperation and handle the differences. Through this summit, I think the cooperation will be strengthened further, and the three countries will have a more matured mechanism to handle and control the remaining differences towards the future solution. So in short, we can expect a stable relationship development among the three, especially the cooperation in the enhancement of free trade and investment, because that's not only related to the three countries' interest, but also related to the stability and sustainability of the international free trade and investment system. So I think the three countries' cooperation will not be only contributed to their strategic countries' interest, but also contribute to the global community's interest.
Mm-hmm. What do you think are the potentials there for the three sides to work together in fourth party or even in multi-party markets?
It's a very good question. Actually, during the past, they related the bilateral, like Japan, China, China, South Korea, have had some plan and the programs to cooperate in the third party, say invest, joint investment in the third party or third country. And now the three countries have a greater plan, say trilateral cooperation or trilateral joint program in the fourth place. That will produce more opportunities, not only for the three parties, but also for the other regions. Especially now, all of the three capitals have a consensus to enhance and facilitate the One Road and One Belt initiative. So the trilateral cooperation in the fourth place will be a very strong vehicle to push forward the One Belt, One Road initiative in a broader region. So I think that the new initiative and the new plan among the three contains great opportunities and potentials.
And another issue that topped the agenda is the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. And we know the three countries do have some different approaches when it comes to this issue, like Japan favors the maximum pressure approach to Pyongyang, while the other two countries would like to prioritize stable relations with their neighboring country. So is it possible for them to seek common grounds, and what kind of role are they going to play together on the Korean Peninsula issue?
Yes, my answer is certainly yes, because the three countries really share the same goal of the peninsula, say the denuclearization. That is the must. That is the consensus and a very clear consensus among the three. Yes, you're right. There are indeed sharp differences between countries, for example, Japan, China, or Japan, South Korea, about the approach. So basically, consensus on the goal and the principle, but the differences on approaches. Simply saying, you're right, Japan prefer one-stop solution, one-stop action, while China, to some degree, South Korea, prefer or support the approach of approach based on phases. The differences can be discussed and solved, I think, based on the consensus. In practice, I think the phase-based approach has to be implemented. I understand Japan and the U.S. Approach stem from the concerns or suspicion about the reversibility of the nuclearization. But I think by phased manner, we can make a sophisticated and a thoughtful arrangement to prevent the denuclearization from going back from reversibility. We can make an arrangement to guarantee the irreversibility of the denuclearization so that we can address and solve the differences on approaches among the parties.
Thank you, Dr. Yang Xiyu, Research Fellow with the China Institute of International Studies. Coming up, Malaysia's Mahathir Mohamad on course to be the world's oldest elected leader. You're listening to Today. Stay with us.
Hi, this is Einar Tangen. The Today Show brings expert local and international perspectives on China's economic and business issues. Having been in law, government, and finance in the United States, I find China's economic and political evolution fascinating, and hope you do also. Thank you for listening.
You're listening to Today with me, Zhao Ying. Thank you for joining us. Mahathir Mohamad is on course to become the world's oldest elected leader at 92 after a shock victory in Malaysia's bitterly fought election. The former prime minister came out on retirement and defected to the opposition to take his one-time protege Najib Razak, beset by corruption allegations. His historic win has ousted the BN coalition, which has been in power since independence in 1957. Najib Razak has accepted the result of the general election. He says that he accepts the verdict of the people. For more on Malaysia's election's dramatic turn, we're now joined on the line by Dr. Teresita Rosario, Senior Research Fellow in the Asian Institute of National University of Singapore. So, Dr. Rosario, are you surprised by the election result?
Yes, hello, good evening. Yes, I was, as most other people are, when they woke up this morning to find out that the opposition candidate, Mohamed Mahathir, had won and had won decisively. I watched the coverage of the elections until 1 o'clock in the morning, and there was still no conclusive evidence. I woke up at 4 o'clock, checked the news again, and he had won. And yes, that is a very clear, very surprising victory.
So for those who might not be that familiar with the Malaysian politics, could you tell us more about Mahathir Mohamad and how did he manage to win?
Okay, Mahathir Mohamad is an old, long-time politician under the BN, and he ruled Malaysia's prime minister for some 23 years. So he knows the politics of Malaysia extremely well. One of the factors that contributed to his victory is precisely this, that he knows the inner workings of Malaysia's politics. In fact, as you said at the beginning of your show, he was the mentor to Najib. So the familiarity with his politics is one of the strong factors. Secondly, Mahathir is a very pragmatic politician. He knew when to enter the game. And he did so under the opposition banner of Anwar Ibrahim. And he somehow knew that the only way to dislodge Najib was to join forces with the opposition, whom he created in the first place. He and Anwar, as you know, was very bitter enemies, even if they were longtime partners in the early 80s and 90s. So this kind of pragmatism certainly helped in his being able to forge a coalition to defeat Najib. And third, Najib is damaged goods. Whatever else can be said about Najib, the so-called Najib brand just didn't work anymore. The corruption scandal, plus also the bread and butter issue, the economy, was really beginning to hurt a lot of the Malays who once traditionally supported him. So capitalizing on these misgivings and shortcomings of Malay politics, Mahathir knew precisely when to enter the political field and also to join the opposition.
But are there doubts within the country on the ability of Mahathir to lead the country at the age of 92?
Well, that's a legitimate concern everywhere, but I think one of the things we need to remember is that age in many countries, particularly in Asian countries, can sometimes be seen as a symbol of not only longevity, but also effectivity, mm-hmm. because they know how to run politics, as opposed to younger ones who are very, very new to the field. And Mahathir is certainly one of those very highly seasoned politicians. Now, the other thing that we need to remember is that while Mahathir is in his 90s, he will not rule by himself. He has a party. He has a coalition of parties. He has capable people around him. He will rule and govern Malaysia through a coalition of parties that he will need to manage. So the whole idea that Mahathir will rule by himself, I think, is quite inaccurate.
But talking about this four-party coalition, actually some believe that it was united largely by the desire to oust Najib. So how will this coalition work together within the government?
Well, with some difficulty, for sure. I'm sure that the horse trading has now begun among the coalition parties as to who will get what position. But again, let's remember that Mahathir knows how to navigate these politics of coalition building rather well because of his long experience. And he knows that he will have to share the spoils of office in order to stay in power and in order to hold the coalition together. Now, who would be best qualified to do that if not someone who has been there before? Which is not to say that there will be no difficulties. There will. But I think that in the face of having ousted a long-standing party for 60 years, Mahathir knows that the ability of his coalition to survive is precisely to be able to hold it together and to apply the pragmatism of his politics that he has done up until now so well.
So are we expecting a smooth transition of power? As we know, no single party within the coalition won a majority.
The latest news is that there is going to be a swearing-in at 9:30 p.m. tonight,
mm-hmm.
and this is already the palace that has announced this. So it looks like Malaysia is on target for a smooth transition. Let's hope, you know, for everybody's sake, for the sake of Malaysia, and not only Malaysia, but Southeast Asia, that this will be a smooth transition. And certainly we here in Singapore, but also in the Philippines, I'm a Filipino, is going to be watching Malaysia very closely on how it navigates this political transition with as much smoothness as we hope.
And what does this political transition mean to the economy and to the market?
Well, you've seen that the markets have already been reacting, some rather negatively. One of the reasons why Mahathir was in a hurry to form the government is because he precisely wanted to erase the uncertainties that are spooking the market. So in a sense, again, knowing politics extremely well, what he did was to, in a way, rush the formation of a new government so that the market will stabilize and send signals that stability is back in Malaysia and that they are able to do business starting tomorrow when he is sworn in as prime minister. And it will be interesting to see how the markets respond tomorrow when the markets open.
And what could this mean to the big projects linked to China's Belt and Road Initiative? Because we know Mahathir has said that Malaysia may renegotiate some deals with China if necessary. What do you make of that?
Well, you know, it is the prerogative of every newly elected politician anywhere in the world to review ongoing initiatives of their predecessor. We see that in America. Donald Trump has done that. With a number of initiatives under the Obama administration. However, review and renegotiation, potential renegotiation, does not mean revoking. I think we need to be clear about that. So what I think needs to be done is that, or I think what Mahathir will do in the first days and months in office, is that he will have to prioritize what the goals of his campaigns were. And I would think that the renegotiation of this big mega project with overseas investors is not going to take center stage. He'll have to do something about the GST. He promised. That was one of the reasons why he was threatened to power by the rural Malays, because he was addressing bread and butter issues. He needs to do something about the sales tax. He needs to do something about the subsidies. These are all economic domestic issues that may have that will generate his attention immediately, and the renegotiation of the big project with China will probably come later. Now, I think, again, I go back to the pragmatism of Mahathir, that once you're in power, you need to look at what you can do feasibly. Campaign promises are one thing, but being in office is another. And so you deliver on some of your campaign promises that are crucial and that are critical to maintain your base and your constituency. The others, those are up for renegotiation, which is what I think is the case for the BIR.
And one last big question, and you have 1 minute to answer it. What do you think are the biggest challenges ahead for the new government?
One is the economic issue. This was why he won. He promised to deliver on the economic front. This he will need to do. Secondly, he will have to work with a coalition, his coalition partners, as you rightly pointed out. And third, he will have to somehow deal with the opposition. Remember, Najib is still a member of parliament, and potentially the opposition can give him a headache. There's 79 seats that they want, after all. So I think, given these three foremost in his agenda, I doubt that he will have time to look at the China BRI project at this point.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Teresita Rosario, Senior Research Fellow in the Asian Institute of National University of Singapore. Coming up, Argentina seeking credit line from IMF, and China marks second domestic Brands Day. Facebook bans foreign ads in Ireland's abortion vote. If you have any questions or want to leave a comment, simply follow us on Weibo. We are 今日, today on CRI. To hear this episode again or catch up on previous episodes, you can download our podcast by searching World News Analysis. You're listening to Today. I'm Zhao Ying. Stay with us. Welcome back. You're listening to Today. I'm Zhao Ying. Let's first check the weather. In China, Beijing will be cloudy tomorrow with a high of 25 degrees Celsius and a low of 14. Chongqing, rainy with a high of 23 and a low of 18. Lhasa, cloudy with a high of 12 and a low of minus 1. Elsewhere, London overcast today with a high of 16 and a low of 8. Washington, D.C., sunny with a high of 29 and a low of 16. Nairobi, possible thunderstorms with a high of 22 and a low of 15. And finally, Canberra expects drizzles tomorrow with a high of 9 and a low of 4 degrees Celsius. Time for a global survey where we look at what's happening around the world. Joining me in the studio is my colleague Wang Xiao.
First up in Asia, Pakistan's parliament has passed a law guaranteeing basic rights for transgender citizens and outlawing discrimination by both employers and private business owners. In India, women activists have criticized the doublespeak attitude of two of India's major political parties who have made sanitary towels a key promise for upcoming state elections.
Now in Oceania, in Australia, in a hope to help boost the critically endangered species, researchers have found that female wombats were more likely to bite a male's bottom when they were most fertile. New Zealand Trade Minister says its leading exporters worry about the implications of exporting to Iran after the US president warned of penalizing those that associate with the country.
Moving on to Africa, in Somalia, a woman has been stoned to death after a court run by military group Al-Shabaab convicted her of having several husbands. In Kenya, a dam has burst near northwest of the capital Nairobi after heavy rain, causing huge destruction and killing at least 20 people.
Turning to Middle East, Israel says its forces have struck almost all of Iran's infrastructure in Syria in response to an Iranian rocket attack on the occupied Golan Heights. Russia's defense ministry says Syria shot down more than half of the missiles fired overnight by Israel.
In Europe, Russia says it is firmly committed to continuing to deepen ties with Iran despite the US decision to quit Iran nuclear deal and impose new sanctions on Tehran. Portugal's president Marcelo Rebelo de Sousa has vetoed a law that would make it easier for people to change their legal gender.
In Latin America, in Brazil, Joaquim Barbosa, a former chief justice on Supreme Court with anti-corruption credentials, says he would not run for the presidency in October, despite a growing clamor for his candidacy. Colombia's war crimes tribunal investigating the atrocities committed during a five-decade-long war has begun collecting testimony and evidence.
And finally, in North America, U.S. President Donald Trump has welcomed home three American detainees released by North Korea. Staying in the country, California has become the first state in the United States to mandate solar panels on new homes and apartments built after January 1, 2020.
Thank you, Wang Xiao. That's the global headline survey for today. Argentina has appealed to the International Monetary Fund to help pull it away from the brink of financial crisis after its currency continued to collapse despite interest rates being raised to 40%. The government has not yet confirmed what kind of deal it is looking for with the IMF, but Bloomberg reports that it is seeking a financing deal worth of $30 billion. For more on this, my colleague Zhao Yan earlier talked with Wang Dan, analyst of Economist Intelligence Unit, and Yao Shujie, Chung Kung Professor of Economics at Chongqing University.
So, Shujie, the peso has plummeted in value in recent weeks, with Macri blaming rising oil prices and U.S. Interest rate hikes for knocking confidence in Argentina's economy. But what do you think are the key problems of this country, and how did Argentina come to this point?
Yeah, the key problem is not necessarily the U.S. interest rate upswing. It's also not necessarily the concept of oil prices. The oil prices at the moment is not that high, although it is relatively higher in recent months. So I think the fundamental problem is internal. The internal issue is a very typical Latin American phenomenon. It arising right from the 1980s or even earlier, 1960s. The fundamental problem of Argentina is similar to other, Latin American countries, is that their internal structural change has not been fundamental. Their lack of innovation, lack of the transformation from the low-end manufacturing to the high-end manufacturing, and the shift toward the modern technology like internet and other things. The other thing is that Argentina is now reaching the point, even 30 years ago, they already reached the so-called middle income level. And up to this level is the concept emergence of social instability, inequality, poverty, unemployment, and also the concept of the cost of domestic production factors, which can hamper the competitive advantage for export. And if without innovation, without technological upgrading like South Korea or even the Chinese Taiwan or Hong Kong or Singapore, then it is very difficult for them to move one significant step forward. So for the last 30 years, Argentina not only suffer from the current financial stress, the Argentina have experienced quite a number of significant financial crises in the past. As you just mentioned, in the early year of this century, and also in 1996, and also during the world financial crisis, Argentina never escaped from the global, regional, and even in domestic crisis. So the fundamental issue here is the internal. They have to pay more attention for structural change and make sure the technological progress can promote further economic growth. Otherwise, Argentina would have to have this sense of zigzag, one step forward and one step backward, which is highly harmful.
So then, as Shujie mentioned, Argentina used to enjoy economic boom in history, but it then fell into the middle-income trap with the economy going down to the crisis level. But how do you look at the bigger picture of its economy? Where is the current point in its economic trajectory?
In fact, at this point, with the new president who has been in the position for 2 years, he's been doing pretty well. The economy is back on track with lower inflation, of course, up until this month. And he has shown also great determination to cut taxes for export and to cut government spending. So among the voters, he has a very high reputation, and many suspect he would resume in a second term. But at the same time, there's also this chronic problem of high inflation. It is very difficult when the inflation reaches a double digit to cut it down, because then it became the self-fulfilling prophecy that for outside investors, they would suspect that the government may not have the capacity to hold in inflation given the poor track record of Argentina in history, especially during the 2001-2002 crisis. So in the longer term, especially just looking at how Argentina is dealing with this crisis, the concern is actually legit.
Mm. So, Shujie, now it appealed to the IMF to help pull it away from the brink of financial crisis. But what kind of help could IMF grant to the country? We still remember that in 2001, Argentina defaulted more than $100 billion worth of foreign debt. And at that moment, the IMF pumped $22 billion into the economy. But did it help?
Well, it helped in the short term, but it doesn't help in the longer term. Because in the short term, yes, you can kill the short-term crisis to make sure there's some confidence in the market and also some confidence in peso and the stock exchange. But the problem is that you take the money from IMF, there are two long-term detrimental consequences. The first thing is that it increases the debt level of the country. So in the longer term, they have to pay more interest for the debt. The other thing that IMF would never come by with just the credit to you. And they would also come about with a lot of other, you know, policy stream and reform, make sure that the country have to do this and that. You know, it would actually, in the longer term, it would increase some sort of inflexibility of the government policy tools to change the domestic or to make any domestic reform. So, yes, I mean, in the long term, it's in the short term, it's helpful, but in the long term, I am still concerned.
Mm. But will is the current economic turbulence in Argentina has some knock-on effects that could spread to other Latin American countries, Shujie?
It's already, yeah, there's a knock-on effect in Latin America already. You know, Venezuela is in a very dire situation. It's much worse than Argentina. And Brazil, yeah, it recovered the last 18 months. But before that, Brazil had negative growth. Although Brazil economy is much in a much better state than the rest of the Latin American economy. So the whole region, you know, lack of direction. The whole reason lack of, you know, internal dynamic, like what we see in the United States and possibly China as well. So Latin America, you know, have to change the way of how they plan ahead for the medium term. They are coping with crisis, but they lack a long-term plan, like we were just discussed the supply side reform in China. I think possibly it is time for some Latin American country to look at the way other countries are doing.
Mm. So then how do you see the general implications of the economic financial challenges facing Latin American countries? Could it be the beginning of the next, regional economic crisis?
The probability is not zero. And now it just seems there's a higher risk. Especially with this example of Venezuela, like Shujie mentioned, and Argentina, there's also a problem in Brazil and Peru. A common problem among all those Latin American countries is productivity. So according to the empirical research done by an American university, the average productivity in Latin American countries stayed about the same as in 1980s, as of now. So along with the political and social uncertainties, as well as this low productivity, there's a real risk that it can be trapped in this low welfare state and also low growth status for a long time. And another problem that is also become more severe in today's world is that the economic structure is quite singular. So many of those economies are based on one or two commodities. And that will be proven to be very fragile when there's external shock. Now the world has a lot more geopolitical issues than before, and this would make foreign investors doubt whether their money would be safer in Latin American countries or just the normal developed countries would be a better place.
Wang Dan, analyst of Economist Intelligence Unit, and Yao Shujie, Chung Kung Professor of Economics at Chongqing University, speaking with Zhao Yan. Coming up, China marks second Domestic Brands Day. You're listening to Today. Stay with us.
I am Alka Acharya. I teach at the Jawaharlal Nehru University in India. Today has organized its programs and it stresses on bringing in a lot of views from all over. It is an extremely good platform for information and analysis, and I wish it all success in the future.
Welcome back. You're listening to Today. I'm Zhao Ying. Today marks the second Chinese Brands Day set by the central government last May, trying to encourage domestic brand building and consumption upgrading. On the latest Bond Ranking Top 100 Most Valuable Chinese Brands published by Fudan University, 8 out of the top 20 brands fall into the category of manufacturing. The brand list meantime shows technology, media and telecommunication is still the most eye-catching sector, while real estate brands are losing luster. Business insiders are suggesting Chinese companies increasingly realize the importance of brand building as more Chinese brands are gaining international fame. For more on this, my colleague Su Yi earlier spoke with Mike Bastian, senior lecturer at Southampton Solent University and visiting professor at the University of International Business and Economics.
People always talk about having more competitive domestic brands in China. How would you evaluate the overall picture in China? Are we seeing more competitive brands in domestic and global markets?
I think we are. I think the picture, I think there's still some way to go, but I think things are improving and improving very, very quickly. And I think that will continue, maybe some sort of exponential development, particularly in the area of technology, high technology brands. Obviously, Huawei is out there. And these Chinese companies are now recognized and respected internationally in certain areas. So things are improving.
So some Chinese brands, like you mentioned, are like rising stars. But compared with those established brands, Western brands, Japanese or South Korean brands, generally speaking, what could be done better by Chinese brands to play catch up?
Well, obviously, there needs to be a catch up. And these countries, Japan, Korea, and obviously the West, they have a lot of experience, a lot of history of brand building. So I think to catch up, what Chinese companies need to do is improve their brands more, infuse them with more emotional association, make better use of Chinese history, Chinese culture. I see that happening more and more. So build stronger emotional brands, emotional ties. And again, coming back to companies like Huawei and Lenovo, they do that now. They sponsor, for example, European football teams. And they realize that it's not enough just to have a competitive product. You need a competitive brand.
Could you give us some specific examples of those Chinese brands that drew your attention? Like some of them have special qualities or maybe smart business ideas.
Well, certainly the general area of fashion and luxury fashion, I think, is an area where we could see an explosion of Chinese brands because we see very, very talented young Chinese fashion designers now showcasing their work all over the world. Specifically when it comes to jewelry, Chow Tai Fook from Hong Kong, that seems to be ranked very, very highly now amongst Chinese people, and one or two other jewelry brands as well. There's no reason why we can't see competitive Chinese brands in all sectors. I think change could happen very quickly.
Hmm. Like you mentioned, luxuries. So when it comes to consumption goods and luxuries, how would you evaluate the taste of Chinese consumer these days? Like maybe, for example, a handbag. Maybe for some people, it could be cooler to have a niche brand than having a Gucci.
Definitely. There's lots of research studies, and I've written lots of articles about the changing nature of Chinese consumption, particularly when it comes to fashion and luxury, where they're not attracted so much to the origin of the brand. So it's not an automatic choice to go for a French brand, an Italian brand, as it has been in the not-too-distant past. I think Chinese consumers are more discerning, they're more rational, they're more thinking, they're more self-confident, and they're leaning more towards their own heritage, their own history. So there's a real opportunity here for Chinese brands because Chinese consumers are not automatically choosing and purchasing the well-known global brands now. So there really is change happening.
Another trend we are witnessing is that some traditional brands, they rebrand themselves and re-enter the market. And so far, there some of them are doing quite well, like some soft drinks or facial cream brands. They disappeared from the market years before, and now they are like star products. Some of them are even sold much expensive than those established names. So how would you see this phenomenon in China? Do you think this will be sustainable for those brands?
I think quite possibly. I think that's consistent with what I just said, where the Chinese consumer very much values nostalgia and their own history and heritage, and quite rightly so. You know, it's a fantastic long history, wonderful associations, and I think they're more self-confident now. So they and they believe that Chinese products are better, better quality, better made. The Chinese government are making a big push here with moving to, you know, from made in China to branded in China and China 2025. So I think this is part of a long-term trend. Yes, Chinese consumers, particularly younger consumers, value Chinese brands more highly.
And how did e-commerce and the digital economy change the formula to be successful, to be a successful brand name nowadays?
Well, I mean, it's changed the nature of shopping fundamentally, not just e-commerce, but m-commerce. I think it was 85% of all the purchases in the last Singles Day were conducted via mobile phones. So these younger generations are very tech savvy. So for Western brands as well as Chinese brands to be successful in China, you have to have a WeChat account. Your WeChat presence has to be very, very appealing. That is an absolute must. And on that, that issue, WeChat and Tencent is a rising global brand as well. So that's sort of leading the way.
You mentioned Chinese companies these days play in nostalgia. So what about those brands going abroad, like to expanding overseas markets? What strategy can they adopt?
Well, I would advise them to play on nostalgia as well, because not only just nostalgia when it reaches out to Chinese history, ancient China, and all those wonderful associations. Not only does that resonate with the Chinese public, it resonates and it will resonate more and more with the global public. So I would get there, advise them. I do advise Chinese companies to really post their Chinese heritage out there. That's a big part of their brand image. And they do that a little bit, but not as much as they should. What they're doing at the moment, the technology brands that have been successful internationally that we all know about, are very, very competitive technically, technologically, and very innovative in terms of their functionality. But they need to play more on Chinese associations globally as well as domestically.
One last question I can think of is that people these days talking about a protectionism, anti-globalization trend. So maybe in the past, like American brands dominated the whole world when the globalization process was going very fast. But now with this new trend, like the world economy, do you foresee a different trend nowadays, like nostalgia or domestic brands?
I think so. I think in terms of the world trade and protectionism, I think a lot of that is coming from America and obviously from Trump. I don't see there being a lot of protectionism and a slowing down in the sort of trade relationships between China, the rest of Asia, and Europe. And Europe is China's biggest export market. So I think there's still a very, very attractive trend there. But certainly consumers, particularly when it comes to luxury and fashion brands, I think we'll be looking for nostalgia and something in the past, a sort of retro look. And I think this will continue. And China and Chinese brands have a huge natural advantage there.
That is Mike Bastian, senior lecturer at Southampton Solent University and visiting professor at the University of International Business and Economics, speaking with my colleague Su Yi. You're listening to Today. I'm Zhao Ying. We'll be back in a minute.
Hello, this is Michael Zhang. Greetings from Los Angeles of the Golden State of California. Thank you today for making me part of your team. I truly enjoy the debates we had and look forward to many more in the years to come.
Welcome back. You're listening to Today with me, Zhao Ying. Now joining us for other news is my colleague Wang Xiao again.
Facebook is banning foreign groups from buying advertisements related to Ireland's abortion referendum. Under Irish law, foreign citizens and groups are not allowed to make donations to Irish campaign groups. The May 25th referendum will decide whether abortion should be legalized in Ireland. The country's abortion laws are among the strictest in the developed world. Facebook says it has learned the lessons of Russian meddling in the 2016 US election and is working on changes to make election campaigns more transparent. The company will soon start requiring political advertisers to be residents in the country where the election is taking place, and Ireland is the first country where Facebook has implemented the rule.
Well, there has been some concerns about the so-called dark ads in Ireland, which means they're only displayed to a specific group by allowing users to see all the paid posts related to the referendum. And this has prompted the Irish government to consider new legislation to regulate the online political campaigning. So as you have said, Facebook has certainly learned a lesson from the US election and the Brexit referendum. So now they have this policy. But at the same time, we see Google also announced similar policy changes relating to the elections in the US, whereby political ads are only permitted if they are placed by U.S. citizens or legal permanent residents, and advertisers will have to provide a government-issued ID and other key information, and the ads will have to incorporate a clear disclosure of who is paying for them. So we see those policy changes in all those tech companies.
Definitely. We also noticed that Facebook has stepped up efforts to tackle fake news ahead of the vote, rolling out a new tool in Ireland to give users more information about political advertisements and sponsored posts in their new feeds. So by doing this, users are now able to see all the contents originated from the Facebook account behind those posts, rather than just the ads or stories targeted at them. And these should also help them identify which posts are shared by friends or their wider network and which result from paid campaigning. And I think from the other point of view, this news shows that how important role social media is playing, not only in our social life, but also in political events. Just as the campaigners in Ireland say, online and offline regulations should be the same. So I think there should be more regulations set up to supervise social media companies.
And it's certainly a positive sign that these massive tech platforms are enforcing policies and building new tools specifically designed to address election interference. And let's quickly move on to our next story.
Well, in China, a man has mistakenly paid nearly 150,000 yuan or $23,000 for two steamed buns, which cost only 3 yuan only. The owner of this takeaway food outlet wanted to give the money back, and he waited for a month for the customer to show up, but it seems that customer didn't find out his loss. So the owner finally found the customer under the help of Alipay, because the money is transferred through this online payment platform, and the customer says he has entered his PIN instead of the price when transforming money.
So it's a reminder for our customers to pay attention while using those online platforms. And some are also suggesting that this is also a reminder for the online payment platforms like Alipay or WeChat to make some amendments, like setting a limit for money transfer. But unfortunately, that's all the time we have for this edition of Today. Chinese Premier Li Keqiang calls on China, Japan and South Korea to safeguard free trade and expand cooperation. Malaysia's Mahathir Mohamad on course to be the world's oldest elected leader. Argentina seeking credit line from IMF. And China marks the second Domestic Brands Day. To listen to this episode again or catch up on previous episodes, you can download our podcast by searching World News Analysis. I'm Zhao Ying. Thank you so much for listening.